Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Forgive me, my lack of Spanish. It feels particularly sinful in Cartagena, of all places, to have to talk to you in the pale, white, meager language of English when it would be more of a song to speak in Spanish. Well, yesterday was Holocaust Memorial Day, Remembrance Day. And on Holocaust Memorial Remembrance Day, the Iranian government, particularly with the imprimatur of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, chose to put out a film which in effect is a Holocaust denial film, which equated Israelis and Nazis. And it was the most depressing thing to realize that was happening. So I have plenty, plenty to talk to you about in respect of the burdens and the ecstasies of Jewish history, and I'll come on to that. But I want to say something else beforehand. Here in Cartagena, in this amazing theater, in the town of Marquez, and in the country of another of my literary heroes, Mutis. And that's to talk just a little bit about what history is. The first obligation of any historian is to make the dead live again. And history is like Cartagena itself. It's in the nature of a memory. It has the thickness of memory and the silkiness, the slipperiness of a dream. And unless you master the world of the memory and the dream in the way in which your great fiction writers and poets have done, you'll simply not fulfill that first qualification of bringing a dead world to life. That's what Marquez did in The General in His Labyrinth and Love in the Time of Cholera and 100 Years of Solitude. There is a wonderful philosopher called R.G. Collingwood in Oxford who wrote a book called The Idea of History. And his idea of history was a personal reenactment. It had an element of poetic internalization of what you've experienced when you read documents. You need to be able to kind of taste the past, to smell it, to breathe it, to live it, to dream it. And then you can start with the analysis. Collingwood described that act of imagination, which is perfect for the Hay Literary Festival, as a gossamer skin, a kind of mantle of shimmering substance, at once available and elusive, thrown over poles. The poles are the hard structure of evidence, of documentary truth. But unless that mantle of gossamer imagination is there again, the history will simply be an analytical exercise. It'll be essentially the political science of the past. It'll be like reading newspaper editorial opinions of another time. And I suppose I first came to history because of that almost childlike quality where you could keep company with the material presence of worlds that were no more. Some of the greatest historical writers from the past, beginning, I think, with Herodotus, as a matter of fact, the Greek, the first historian of all, who was as interested in the Persians and his enemies and in the Egyptians simply for their exotic peculiarity. He was very interested by the fact, as he imagined, and was told that Egyptian women urinated standing up. This has Herodotus in a kind of madness of curiosity. Herodotus did two things. He tried to actually describe the worlds of those who were not like him, who were not Greeks, who were the enemy, who were other people. So he actually obeyed the other important principle of history, which is to bring a world to life which is not your world. History is a reach for people who are lost to you in time and space. one of the historians who was a great writer in his way and who was incredibly popular in the 19th century was Thomas Babington Macaulay, became Lord Macaulay, now really forgotten, very little read. Macaulay, along with Ruskin and Dickens and Carlyle, were on every single shelf of a 19th century reader. They were what saved Victorian Britain from being a machine of material cupidity and utilitarianism. And Macaulay realized, he said, he was very arrogant, precocious young boy. He published an essay when he was just 25 years old about what history was. And Macaulay does something rather wonderful. He actually makes the case for paying attention to the other great bestseller of the 1800s, Sir Walter Scott, the historical novelist. Because if he looked simply at his fellow academic historians, he felt he would only get, as he put it, the bones of history already crumbling into dust, which would fall through his fingers. When he went to Scott, he could hear the songs of the past, of the borderland between Scotland and England. He could sort of listen to those Scottish border voices. And he did, in fact, go and collect ancient ballads when he was writing his own history. And Macaulay told a beautiful, fanciful story, which I'm sure Marquez and Mutis and Colombians know about. And it's a story of a master glazier of Lincoln Cathedral, one of the great cathedrals in England. Someone who made those beautiful stained glass windows that throw the rainbows of light on the interior of a church. And the master glazier is confident that he is the greatest glazier in England, but he walks into the church one day and sees a window of such astonishingly phenomenal beauty, of which he had been completely unaware before, that he needs to find out who has done this thing. It was a window which had not been programmed to be remade. So he summons the unknown maker of this window, the window much more spectacular than anything he himself could have made. And a young boy comes out, an apprentice craftsman, and said, I hope you're not angry with me, master, and said, no, I'm sad because I realize you are greater than I will ever be. But how did you do this? And the young boy said, every day when you have finished your work, master, you've left broken pieces of colored glass behind. I have followed you and picked up the pieces of glass, and with those ill-considered trifles, the little trifles, I made my window. And the story is very dramatic because the master glazier is so astonished by this that he kills himself. It's a little over the top, especially for the Victorians, in a fit of chagrin that he'd left these pieces of beauty behind. Macaulay said that is what the true historian has to do, has to discover the bits and pieces that other people leave behind. When I came to history, as a child myself, 1940s and 1950s, I was born in 1945. I was interested in history as a very small child. The reason was, in Britain, there were two destroyed histories. I knew that, but not completely destroyed. British history had been bombed. My father walked me around the blackened, sooty ruins of the city of London. And Jewish history, which had nearly been exterminated. The object of the Nazis was not just to destroy the bodies of the Jews, but wipe out every trace of their cultural memory. They'd been unsuccessful in both those enterprises, but I was aware that history was in a state of mutilation, that it was half destroyed, that it was almost destroyed. And the remains of it were a kind of sadness. Physically, London was a very dark place. It was dark and brown and inward. It's not like the London now. Oh, somebody's crying. Have I made you cry? I didn't want to do that. Also, I'm weighed down with microphones here, so the burden of history I'm seen to be wearing on my waist here, actually. Just not where you want it. You want it up here or not. Occasionally, it always creeps down. British and Jewish history had survived, but only just. And because London was so inward and dark, for me as a child, the two great stories were ablaze with light, but they were stories, they were books. One was the Bible, and also the great Jewish epic of resurrection, which ended up in the creation of the State of Israel. Oh, those days were much simpler in terms of the narrative, and the other was British history itself, particularly as told by Churchill. Churchill, you have to remember, ladies and gentlemen, was a historical writer while he was also being a prime minister. So all these things were kind of woven together in my mind. But when my father walked me around castles and bomb sites, and when we read the Bible together, it was those little broken pieces of glass, the fragment of a song, the dreams of Jacob and of Joseph that really bit into my imagination. And one of the books of the Bible, which I thought was so extraordinary, and I still think it's absolutely extraordinary, I wrote about it in my History of the Jews, is the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel is the most kind of drug trip-like of all the prophetic books. Ezekiel is the craziest and most delirious of all the prophets. I can't believe that David Bowie never wrote a song about Ezekiel, except maybe he did. And there is an amazing moment in Ezekiel where an angel appears to him bearing the holy books and says, "Son of man," this extraordinary persona that Ezekiel creates where he describes himself as son of man, "consume this." And Ezekiel says, "I will," and, you know, starts reading it. And the angel says, no, you misunderstand me. I don't want you to just read it. I want you to eat it now. And only when actually you've swallowed it and digested it physically will you be fit to actually repeat it and read it. So there's the sense actually of digesting the Bible became kind of crazily literal in the book of Ezekiel. So Jewish history is full of these moments of ill-considered trifles, of tiny things which expand into enormous things, people whose lives haven't been thought about very much, who turn out to have incredible power for the narrative of Jewish history. One of those I write about in the second volume of the Jewish history, second and last volume, which I'm writing right now, is an extraordinary man called Leonid Dissomi, who was a playwright, who's an Orthodox observant Jew, but he was a playwright in the city of Mantua, and also in Ferrara for a while. And Sommi actually had not exactly in a theater like this, but in a Renaissance court. Sommi had the ability to conjure up fantasies and miracles on stage and do it not just for a Jewish audience, but also for the court as well. So often the people one thinks of, and what that tells us really, is another story of what life was like for the Jews in Renaissance Italy. Officially, the life for Jews in Renaissance Italy was one of separation, of the creation of ghettos in Venice and Rome. Next year sees the 500th anniversary of the creation of the ghetto of Venice. So Jewish history is studied with these unlikely points of brilliance, the material presence of living history, the unlikely, the unpredictable, the surprising. And the problem for most of the world, and for Jews too as well, I think, about Jewish history is its absolute domination by the calamities, the calamity of the Holocaust, and its sequel in the bitter, unrelenting conflict of the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians. Jewish history, even though at the beginning of my remarks I was complaining, and how could I not, about a Holocaust denial film coming out of Iran yesterday of all days. Nonetheless, what I really wanted to do was write a history, particularly in that volume that's been translated into Spanish, which was somehow innocent of the inevitability of catastrophe. A Jewish history which had color to it, the kind of color out there in your streets in Cartagena, the kind of sound, the music of the performances of Leone di Somme, a history in which Jews were not simply waiting for catastrophe to be round the corner. It's true that given the way Jewish history has been what it is, it's a good idea always to have a suitcase handy, I think, actually. But I wanted to give Jewish history back something of its free will and its independence, to take away some of the tragic determinism which has dominated it such a lot. And that, of course, is in a way easier said than done, but it's why I began the volume that I wrote not with the Bible and not with an intimation of catastrophe. Hello, Daniel. Better late than never, but here you are. Daniel's a wonderful photographer who actually made me think about dreams, because actually he insisted on taking my photograph as if I was lying down in the middle of sleep dreaming, and I thought, what's he doing? And then suddenly, subsequently, I realized exactly what I've been saying, the dreamlike quality of history. But the reason I started the book the way I did, I set it in Egypt, in a colony of mercenary Jewish soldiers in the Upper Nile, is precisely because in the 4th and 5th century BC, this is a community that writes back and forth to Jerusalem. The Jerusalemites were in the business of building what will become the Second Temple. But at that particular moment, the colony at Elephantine, whose records have been preserved in miraculously intact papyri, just the other day, in fact, actually, these papyri are written in Aramaic, the language of the greater Persian Empire, the 5th century BC, and are really extraordinary because they're not like the Bible. They're not full of messages from God, full of the great epic of sin and calamity and repentance and destruction. They're full of things like prenuptial marriage contracts and wills and house building rows and bodily complaints and slave girls who are being koshered up for a Jewish marriage. So it's precisely this kind of unconsidered trifle, the sense that the daily life, quotidian humdrum things are a kind of resistance to the immense tumultuous forces of tragedy, was something which attracted me a lot. So the book begins with the sentence, it's a bit vain and conceited to quote oneself, but it's something like, in the beginning, not in the beginning as written by the prophets and patriarchs, but in the beginning in Elephantine, a mother and father were worried about their son. They're worried about actually the fact that he's going off on a bad posting in a military garrison and so on. So I wanted this to give a kind of sense of the freshness and innocence of how do you lead a Jewish life, particularly a Jewish life abroad, rather than something that's always waiting for impending disaster. But as I say, that is often, you know, it can be more easily said than done. There are problems that attach to that as well. One of the most important things about Jewish history almost happens, it's almost happened accidentally. And I've done a lot of things as well as doing Jewish history, but one of the great problems, I don't know, maybe it's one of the most severe problems that we're facing right now in the world, is how do you share space? By which I mean physical space. How do you share a piece of land? How do you share a country? How do you share a cultural community with people who are not like you without the obligation to oppress or persecute or even kill each other? This was not supposed to be a problem when I was growing up. It was thought that the horrors of the Second World War had actually disposed of this, but it turns out it is something that has something which is almost kind of consuming the world in the most dire and difficult and dominating way. And on that subject, the Jews have very much to say. Of course, Jewish history is not the only history which is dominated by the struggle to find a place of safety, a place where you can actually share a life, you can retain your own identity, but then at the same time, share the space with other people. And this is being played out all over the world. It's now being played out in France, in Europe, but it's not an exclusively Jewish problem, obviously. But it is a problem which the Jews have centuries-long experience of. And I suppose actually what one needs to be said at the beginning, because one thinks now catastrophically of brutal separations, especially in Israel itself and in the Middle East. What needs to be said is that Jews in Jewish history, since they were accused of wanting to be separate, never ever chose separation. If you look at some of the great towns in Palestine, both before and after the destruction of the Second Temple, a town like Beit She'an, for example, you'll find a city, and you can go and look at the archaeology, a city that's shared by Jews and non-Jews, by Syrians and Greeks and Romans, or an extraordinary city that, you know, there are other extraordinary cities which have actually synagogues with mosaic floors in them as well. Tzipori, Sepphoris, where we filmed in a BBC series, which is where one of the first books of the Talmud, the Mishnah, was written. But there too you can find houses decorated with pagan mosaics and synagogues absolutely festooned with extraordinarily brilliant stone. And it's very difficult to sort of tell them apart. Cohabitation, our great problem in a contemporary world, has been as much a feature of Jewish history as brutal separation, destruction, ghettoization, walls, and all the rest of it. And the separation was essentially thrust on Jews, and it kept on being thrust on Jews for a long time. Before the Venice Ghetto, already there was a sort of sense in medieval Christianity. There were lots of medieval Europe was full of Jewish districts and quarters. And the sense was that the Jews somehow were a contaminant in the Christian world. They were a kind of walking infection. Jews were not supposed to hire Christian servants. There was an incredible horror, of course, of any kind of possibility of Jewish sexual relations with Christian women or the other way around. So these barriers always had to be built. This happens very, very early on in the beautiful city of Antioch in Syria, now mostly Antakya, destroyed in the Syrian civil war. There were terrifying sermons preached by John Chrysostom. And we're talking now about the years of the 4th and early 5th century AD, very, very early on in the experience that Jews had in the Christian world, experience of exile. John Chrysostom complains that Christians and Jews are living too closely together, that they need to be physically separated out, that actually some of the sermons that are preached in synagogues are so compelling that good Christian women, and he stresses Christian women, are going to hear them for a kind of theatrical entertainment, and as a result are tempted by falling into the errors of the old Jewish religion. So above all, he stresses a kind of physical separation between Christian and Jewish communities, and that already casts a long shadow over the Jewish experience in the Christian world. It goes on further into a kind of insane mythology of the blood libel, which I want to talk just a bit about in a minute. But what was very striking to me again, in the same time which we were able to rejoice in the theatre world of Leone di Somme and the world of the Venice Ghetto, which was a rather porous ghetto, and after, in fact, the papacy of a number of popes who were friendly towards Jewish rabbis and scholars because they were becoming extremely interested in learning Hebrew because they thought that Kabbalistic, the mystical texts of Judaism, held the secret to the timing of the second coming of the Savior. So you actually find in the early 1500s a series of popes actually taking lessons from masters of esoteric Hebrew texts. Then comes along Pope Paul IV in the middle of the 16th century, and one of the first things he does in July 1555 is issue an edict called Cum Nimis Absurdum. And we're in the world of the high Renaissance of Michelangelo and Vasari and a time of European culture which is supposed to be governed by rational thinking. Cum nimis absurdum, rather like John Chrysostom, John the silver and golden tongue of Antioch, says, Christianity will never be safe so long as Christians and Jews are living in physical proximity of each other. And he decrees the ghetto of Rome, but he does other things too. He restricts the occupations that Jews can follow. Only a certain number, old clothes, low-level banking, loans, pawns, and all the rest of that, whereas Jews have been involved in a great number of craft occupations in particular. And above all, he renews something which had become lax, which throws yet another very long dark shadow of the possibility of Jews sharing space, and that is Jews must wear different clothes. They must wear the hat, which singles them out from everybody else. They must wear a particular badge. It's a yellow badge too. It's not a yellow star. It's a yellow, the two little tablets like the Ten Commandments. So the sense in which actually we want the Jews to be physically separate, but if they mingle among us, we had better know who they are so we can keep clear of them as if they were a walking disease or an infection, happens at the height of the Renaissance. And that separation goes on and on and on. The Nazis were not the first by any means to dream that up. And along with it is something even more terrible and frightening, and that is the blood libel I mentioned some time ago. Some of you may well be familiar with this, and its origins were in England and France in the 13th, actually the 12th century, mostly in the 13th century. And the blood libel runs as follows, that its basic premise is that the Talmud says that the Jews need blood to bake their Passover matzot, and that they are required, when being Orthodox Jews, to kill Christians, particularly kill Christian children, and drain the blood in order to bake their matzot. Now, if you go online, you can find a Jordanian imam reciting that story last week for the cameras. If you go online, you can find the Syrian defense minister under Hafez Assad, a man called Mohammed Tlas, repeating what he describes as the historical truth of the blood libel for contemporary generations. It wasn't an accident, and I'm not a friend of Benjamin Netanyahu or his policies in Israel, but it was extraordinarily shocking at some of the demonstrations that took place at the time of the Gaza War, which showed Netanyahu actually with the dead body of a child in his mouth with blood dripping from it. It was so dramatically, obviously, a recall of the sense in which Jews aren't actually human at all. They're living vampires that walk among us. Between the kind of hideous demonology of the Jews as not properly human and its origins in the Middle Ages, there was an extraordinary consistent repetition of the blood libel. It comes up again. It has to be said that very often popes and bishops, and in the case of the Ottoman Empire, sultans, go on record denouncing the insane fabrication of the blood libel. But it still has, as you can tell from the fact that it's still alive out there on the web, an extraordinary, tenacious and horrifying history. It appears in Poland in the 18th century. It appears again in Hungary in the 19th century. In 1840 in Damascus, a Capuchin priest, not a child, goes missing. And the entire Jewish community is supposed to actually have conspired to murder this Capuchin priest. In fact, the chief rabbi of Damascus is taken prisoner and tortured for days on end. His genitals are kind of destroyed. He's virtually, you know, murdered by his jailers before there's an international hue and cry, which ended up both in the Pasha in Egypt, Muhammad Ali, and the Ottoman Sultan denouncing the venomous fabrication, the poison of the blood libel. The thing never stops. There's another case during just before the Russian Revolution and after. So, you know, to those who think that a lot of the trouble in the Middle East has been caused by the creation of Israel, I don't want to say this is a complicated... Absolutely, we'll welcome questions about the Middle East now. There is a long, even though I wanted to write a history of rejoicing, sometimes history, I say this with some intensity and emotion, sometimes history is not just a walk down memory lane. It's not just playing games with the past. It's not just dressing up in costumes. It actually summons you to a kind of moral engagement. It wasn't so much Herodotus, but Thucydides who invented that heavier side of what the historical vocation is when he wanted to warn Athens against a repetition of the catastrophic expedition to Syracuse. And I've spent a lot of my life running away from Jewish history. I wrote a slightly dull book early on about the Rothschilds in Israel. It's the second book I wrote. And then, even though I kept up with Jewish history, I read Hebrew, I'm fully part of the Jewish world, I thought actually that Jewish history was too intensely personal for me. I wanted to deal with cultures that were not my own, the French Revolution, the world of art, the world of the Dutch in particular. But as Jewish history became more fraught, more tied up with the pain and suffering, you know, the double calamity, the calamity of the Palestinians, the calamity of Jews after the Holocaust, it was an impossible thing to walk away from, and an impossible thing to walk away from the darker side of it as well. And so there I am very much stuck. And to those who think really that the trouble in the Middle East was caused by the creation of the State of Israel, I would say the opposite. In a way. Not that I'm exonerating. I'm no supporter of Israeli policy in the West Bank. I say in the television films, I'm not a furtive or shamefaced Zionist. I'm an unapologetic Zionist in the sense in which, given this long history of grotesque dehumanization, and given also the fact that in the late 1930s, the United States and Britain to some extent, and virtually the entire rest of the world, slammed their doors down just at the moment when the Jews were in the deepest and darkest of trouble. How could people who've experienced this history not want somewhere where they can make a shelter for themselves? Zionism does not cause anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism caused Zionism. It's that way round. Now to the Middle East at the moment and how Jewish history bears on it. One thing I said to you earlier, everybody, is that the Jews have a long experience in trying to share space with other people, with other cultures. The Middle East, for hundreds of years, towns like Alexandria, Cairo, Tunis, Damascus, Baghdad, Aleppo, my own family, the Sharmas, came from Izmir, from Smyrna, were such places where you had Muslim neighbors Greek, Armenian, Christian neighbors. It wasn't a paradise. It was not, you know, there was always trouble between the communities, but there was a sense actually of a mixed up world in the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, a little bit like that in the Habsburg Empire. There was one extraordinary history, which I actually write about in volume two, which I hope will be published towards the end of this year. And that's the world of China. There was an extraordinary Jewish community in the city of Kaifeng in northern China, city of a million, which we know about from the Jesuit discovery of the Kaifeng Jewish community, where genuinely there was no problem about the Jews were completely integrated into the world of classical China. They were soldiers and generals and civil servants and educators and teachers and tax collectors and even farmers as well. But that was the Chinese experience is fairly unique. But there were these other places of shared space. And the issue, of course, when the Zionist movement got going was, could a Jewish home be part of a shared space? And there were some who thought this was impossible, like Jabotinsky, from whom the line of Netanyahu's Likud party descends. And there were others like Ahad Ha'am, Asher Ginsberg, and more particularly Chaim Weizmann as well, who thought it was impossible to run away from the fact that Jews and Arabs would somehow have to live together. Now the best you can do is two states for two peoples, at least living alongside each other. And the catastrophe of our own time and of Jewish history and of Muslim history as well is of the imperative of separation, of uniformity. Only one religion, one kind of people in one place, another kind of religion, another kind of people have nothing to do with each other, who want to impose a kind of tribal or religious uniformity on the spaces they occupy. This is simply a recipe for endless, relentless, unforgiving, horrific, mutual violence. But I'm not a Pollyanna, I'm not enormously optimistic, but let me tell you, to cheer you up a bit, that even amidst the daily horror that goes on, stabbings in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and wherever, and Israeli bombings of Gaza and so on, when the rockets fall on kibbutzim, the bad news, there are tiny points of good news as well. They are tiny, but they are to be honored for the fact that they are actually there. When we were filming our television series for the BBC on the story of the Jews, we went to a school just on the edge of Jerusalem, and there are now six of them up and down Israel called Hand in Hand, where the students learn in both Arabic and Hebrew. And the governing boards of these schools are both Israeli Arab and Jewish Israeli as well. You know, I mean, they have an enormous amount of trouble. And the wonderful thing about the kids is that the teenagers who are there are not wild-eyed idealists. They don't expect peace to break out at any moment. They wanted to, you know, talk about pop music and where you could get decent falafel and where you could, you know, make out in the darkness, really. And they go to each other's houses. What they cannot do, and this is the limits of a shared space, of the kind of beautiful, redemptive epic of cohabitation, which also is at the heart of much Jewish history. What they can't do, they can't walk down the street in Jerusalem together. Neither the Israeli Arabs, let alone Palestinians, there are some Palestinians in the Hand in Hand school in Jerusalem as well, or the Jews, because actually if they're seen to be together by their respective friends, they will be attacked. So there are certain ways in which they can share a space and certain ways in which they can't. Neve Shalom, go online and see Neve Shalom, which I love, which is a village which is both Palestinian and Israeli Jewish in the Valley of Jezreel. And I went there and talked to, and this has been Its demise has always been predicted because it seems to be so impossible that such a place could survive amidst the polarization of feeling and identity, amidst the endless war of identity politics. But Neve Shalom does survive in its way. And when I went there, the first thing I was struck by again were just a playground of kids, of 11, 9, and 10, and 11-year-olds playing football. And they were shouting, you know, at the goalkeepers and at their own players indiscriminately in Hebrew and Arabic. And you take what you can, you take the little ill-considered trifles, those little broken pieces of glass and light where you can. And I could go on. I mean, you know, you never really hear the good news in the midst of the rainstorm of horrible news. The one also I'm just getting to know now is an organization called Eco Peace. And this is actually, it has offices in Tel Aviv, in Amman, and in Ramallah. I believe it's Ramallah or Jenin. So it is genuinely a kind of Israel, Jordan, West Bank kind of cooperation to deal with environmental problems. And environmental problems also that affect Gaza as well. One of the projects that they're dealing is cleaning up with terrible issues of raw sewage pollution in Gaza, the shrinking of the Dead Sea, and many other things. And in fact, there was a conference, I think, about 3 months ago in Tel Aviv, which brought together people from the various strands of the Eco Peace organization. It was also a conference which actually had a fairly fundamentalist mullah sit on the same in the same committee as an ultra-Orthodox Jewish rabbi. So there are places why I am, you know, why Eco Peace, I suppose, strikes a particular chord for me, is that it's the fate of the physical plant, indeed of the planet, of this crowded, blood-soaked little piece of earth. The sense in which there are some issues that don't need to hear from the mullahs and the rabbis, from the politicians, that just require the practical problems of how to fix up the neighborhood. And believe you me, if one wants to find a space in which the rain of ash from the Auschwitz crematoria does not choke out the light, then you find a small moment where fixing up the neighborhood is also a part of Jewish history. Thank you. Now, time to take questions from you. And let me see, where is my friend with the trousers? Oh, here we go. Yes, thank you. So what do? I put this on and then we'll... And are you going to find the questioners, or how are you going to do that? Right. Okay, so... I need to be on 5. It says 6, or is that the right... Okay, I've got it. So I'm listening to it now here. Okay. Good. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So, does anybody want to ask any questions? Yes, there's a gentleman.
Pardon, English. Is that in?
Do you want to explain to...
He's going to talk in English.
Oh, okay. Good.
Okay. Thank you very much. You have had an excellent presentation. I have enjoyed it very much. But I wonder, you're talking maybe 3,000 years of history, maybe more. And through all that time, many people have passed in the history, or people from different nations and different areas, and have been there. Many of them have had enemies, and many of them has overcome and still survive. But it's very strange that with the Jews, All the time they have enemies trying to destroy them.
Right.
What would be the
right
the reason why they keep time keeps on going
right.
and it never ends, and it never, the persecution never ends. It has different stage, but it goes on and on like a
right. bit. Yeah. No, we call it tsuras in Yiddish, trouble. I will repeat the question for those of you. Did you all hear the question? But no, okay, no, they didn't. But if I repeat it, can you translate it into Spanish? Okay, good. So the gentleman said that there are many cultures and civilizations that have had to deal with trouble and hatred, but they've overcome it and then they've gone on to, you know, I mean, there are cultures which have been deeply wounded by it. The Armenian massacre, it's hard to say, you know, Armenians survive all over the world, but they too have been deeply wounded. Why is it that the Jews have had to deal with it more or less the entire time? To which I want to say, in the first place, it didn't help to kill Christ. You know, that was probably, that was, in retrospect, it was a mistake, you know, really. But it really did have kind of profound, not to be facetious and trivial about it, though. There is a particular moment at the beginning of the history of Christianity, which is very important, which is the difference between, as I understand it, I'm not a scholar of early Christianity, between James and the Church of Jerusalem, which was a kind of reforming Judaism, and what happens under Paul. Paul is much more militant in wanting Christians to part company altogether with their Jewish heritage in a way in which James and the Church of Jerusalem are not been. So already the sense really that if you were going to be a Christian, you had to keep your distance away from Jews. This is before the nightmare stories, you know, of blood libels and so on got going, was already a cause of a kind of social trouble. And, you know, it's wonderful during the Second Vatican Council that the church was finally able to absolve Jews of the guilt of having crucified Jesus, crucified the Savior. But it only really definitively happens. Yes, and it's happened more recently too, that's right. But the papal edict I was talking about of Paul IV, cum nimis absurdum, restated the fact that since the Jews killed the Savior, they would have to go on forever bearing the burden of that guilt, as though every Jew was a criminal. You know, just in that edict. I'm not saying it was the view of the church, all of the church. It wasn't, but that was serious. But I also want to say, in a little bit of a happier vein, that there have been places, I live in one, the United States of America, there have been places where Jewish culture has thrived. Yes, there are anti-Semites in America. There have been anti-Semitic moments. But by and large, the Jews found a home in America, which did not ever really create ghettos or anti-Semitic legislation. Now, why was that? The same, I think, for some, to a large extent, was true of the Ottoman Empire as well, the Turkish Empire. Why was that? Because America is not founded on tribal or ethnic identity. It's a culture of immigrants. Essentially, American identity is vested in a political idea, that of democracy as founded by the founding fathers. And at least until we get to, this is what makes the hideousness of the rhetoric in the present election campaign against immigrants and against Muslims by the likes of Ted Cruz and Donald Trump so profoundly un-American. Because two of the things that the founding fathers did was one to say the state must have nothing to do with religion. That's in the First Amendment to the Constitution, thanks to Thomas Jefferson. And secondly, we are proudly a nation of immigrants. In that circumstances where there was no overall single tribal ethnic identity, the Jews could just be another one of those groups who could come to America. So I've lived in America half my life. I'm very well aware of its many, many faults. But that made it possible. Where where it was possible for Jews to be just another immigrant culture in a world of immigrants, they were likely to have a happier life. So, there have been many moments also where Jews felt they could be, there was not an allegiance problem in the first half of the 19th century in Germany of all places. There were people Jews who felt they could be good Germans and good Jews at the same time. What they'd not reckoned with was Wagner and the whole culture that, as Germany became more powerful, so it became more tribal, so it became about the German past. But, you make a point. We say to ourselves, why is it, the question you ask, very good one, why are the Jews having so much trouble? It's the same question we now ask of the world. Why is it that people cannot share the same space to live together with different religions and different identities without wanting to kill each other? It's the same question. So, yeah, thank you for it, though. It's a good question.
So I have a question, and I'll say it in English and then in Spanish.
Where are you? Where are you?
Over here on the balcony.
And where are you? There. Come to me there.
I'm here.
Yes, hi.
Hi. So I will say my question in English and then Spanish, so there's no need for translations. At this time in history, we are experiencing something that has never been experienced before, which is the instant communication afforded by social media and social networks. Given the fact that this does allow people, youth especially, to communicate in a direct way, to know each other, do you see this as a force of positive hope for the future?
Do you?
I do. I mean, I've seen some groups.
Oh, there you are. I'm looking up and I'm looking. There you are. I'm so sorry. Yeah, you do. Good.
Tell me why. I've seen some groups that have facilitated peace studies, coexistence studies, and communication between groups of youth in Tunisia, Northern Africa, Middle East, Libya, and Israel. And they're all communicating with each other through these groups. Now, I didn't do the question in Spanish, so I don't know if anybody's following.
Did you all understood the question? Has it been translated? It has, okay. It's about social media and the internet. And I wasn't being cute in asking to hear what you had to say, because you want to hear the good news. I think we all thought, really, and we do still think. What's your name, first name? Lorianne? Okay. That we would like, the web, the World Wide Web, to be the digitization of cosmopolitan happiness. I would love that. But what has turned out, I would love it to be the case, and I'm not joking. And, that's why I wanted to hear from you about places where it is the case, where it actually brings people together. But, famously, ISIS is dangerous because it is a brilliant exploiter of the web to take an absolutely extreme, the ultra, almost, crassly extreme example. What the web can do is establish digital communities of identity as well. You just listen to the people who seem to share your prejudices. People read, can you hear me? Sorry, more people read another horrible fabrication about the Jews, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The notion is that there's this secret conspiracy of Jews who come together in darkness and undercover to plot world domination. That also belongs to the blood libel period, by the way. It was always thought to be a kind of grand committee of Jews who planned the abduction of Christian children. More people are reading the Protocols of the Elders of Zion now than ever before because it's available on the web. And I don't know what to do about this. You can have monstrous communities of solidarity who communicate with each other as though the fantasies and falsehoods that they, ingest are true and are unchallenged, really, by actually having contact with other people. So I think the web, I would say it's it's neutral in respect, actually, of bringing communities which are far apart. It can do as much damage in polarizing as it can in bringing communities together. But I would love to believe what you're saying is right. Yes, we've got time for another.
Here.
At the back.
Okay. Quisiera. Okay, I will do it in English. It's okay.
Oh, English? Okay, thank you.
Okay. How do you evaluate? There's a period, which is the Cordoba Caliphate, where Muslims were ruling, but there was a cohabitation with Jews and Christians. And I think I would like to hear your evaluation on that. And don't you think that Jews in Israel have now something like a syndrome where the victim has become now the aggressor against
the
Palestinians?
That's a completely different question. There are two issues. No, I think the worst thing you can do is kind of mutual victimization in Israel. Let me take the second one. And I think it is, you know, it's not great that actually there are random stabbings of mothers in front of their children. But if we get into who's to blame, to your second point, I don't like the fact that politicians like Benjamin Netanyahu always invoke the Holocaust to justify the expansion of settlements or a particular moment of brutality. But, you know, Israel is in a rough neighborhood. It's surrounded by, in the case of ISIS in particular, you know, an organization that wants to exterminate it. So, you know, the difference is between in Israel, what Israel is, which is a complicated, highly heterogeneous culture in which liberalism, you know, flourishes alongside extreme conservatism and messianic Jewish belligerence, even Jewish terrorism, and what the government does. And you can really, you know, feel, as I do, unapologetic about the existence of Israel and still be, as you know, many writers who come to Hay, David Grossman and Amos Oz and all the rest, still feel extremely exercised and critical of what the government does. Now, the first question you asked is about the way Jews lived in the period. You're talking about medieval Islam, right? You're talking about the Umayyad Caliphate, and the Fatimids and so on. Yes, it was. Islam in those days had an obligation to protect the people of the book, both Christians and Jews. But of course, it wasn't the case that Jews actually were equal subjects. The Jews under Islam also had to wear identifications of dress. There were certain things they were not. They also had to pay an annual tax to show that they were subjects of Islam. That maybe wasn't so bad, although if you didn't pay it, you were given extremely brutal treatment. One of the things you were not allowed to do, there were things that Jews didn't care about. You're not allowed to build a building taller than a mosque. Who cares about that? That's fine. You weren't allowed to ride a horse. You can only ride a mule or a donkey. But there was one thing that really was a problem. You were never allowed to carry a weapon. You were never allowed to carry a weapon, which meant that actually if you were attacked by robbers or brigands on the highway, you were pretty much defenseless. So you were very much a second-class citizen, but still you prospered, there's no question. Particularly in Umayyad Spain, in Nasri, Granada, it was possible for Jews to be rich, prosperous. That was indeed a cosmopolitan world. We know from the extraordinary record of the Cairo Geniza just how far flung from India to the Atlantic Ocean, you know, Jews could thrive. But that was, you know, that was a kind of very open-ended kind of Islam. It was not the kind of Islam that's dominated by Salafist and Wahhabi fundamentalism. I mean, the real sorrow is that I don't want to speak, you know, for Islamic scholars, but Islam and Messianic Judaism have gone backwards. Judaism too in Israel has become more fundamentalist, creating a problem. For example, they don't regard the children of Russian Jews who had one non-Jewish parent as Jews. All these ways to say you're not pure. All these ways to say you're not pure have afflicted both the Jewish and the Muslim community. And it's a disaster.
aquí.
I know.
Aquí.
I want to. Oh, we got time for one more question. Or
sí, aquí en español.
Where are you?
Aquí. Here. Aquí. Aquí.
There.
Okay.
You can do it in español. Spanish, if you like.
En español.
Yeah.
De las piezas del vitral que usted desechó, que desecharon, que usted recogió, ¿cuál llama? Okay.
I'm not hearing it. I'm so sorry. I'm not hearing the translation. Maybe. Oh, wait a minute. I'm on the wrong
Hello?
Channel.
Okay.
Okay. I'm on the wrong channel. Can you put it on there?
Aló.
Okay.
Okay. De las piezas del vitral desechadas que usted recogió para escribir su historia.
I can't hear it. I'm so sorry. I can't hear. I can't hear you. Why doesn't say what you want to say and then someone will tell me what you're saying? Okay, that's the easiest way.
Okay. De las piezas desechadas del vitral que usted recogió para escribir su historia, ¿cuál le llamó profundamente la atención a usted?
I need to know. I can't hear it on this.
Here, I can translate you, if you want.
Well, just tell me. Someone just tell me.
Yes, I can tell you.
Oh. I'm so sorry. Yeah, so sorry. I'm not getting it, actually. Okay, do you want to give me the, as a historian, what?
Hello.
Can someone translate for me?
Yes, from the pieces of the crystals that you that you pick up from the pieces of different...
Oh, yes, yes.
Yes, which one do you think, do you realize more important?
Okay, that's a wonderful question. I'm glad. Thank you. It's a wonderful question. It's the following, really. I suppose when you go to look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, or it's anything which tells you that the Jews have survived without castles and palaces and fortifications and armies and governments and institutions. They've survived in words, in books, in holy books and in not so holy books. And sometimes you find scraps of those books, which are wonderful. And I'll give you one example, which is a good place. It's a sad story and a happy story to end. In the Warsaw Ghetto, there was a young historian who I identify with, called Emanuel Ringelblum, not so young, in his 30s, who'd been the star pupil of a great Polish professor in the 1920s called Simon Dubnow. Emanuel Ringelblum realized very early on that he and Jewish Warsaw was not going to survive, not going to live, even in 1940, certainly in 1941. And some of his own students were in the ghetto with him, and he brought them together in an organization in Yiddish called Oneg Shabbos, or Oneg Shabbat, which is a name also given to the gathering of Friday night Sabbath. And what those students had to do was what historians do, to gather documents. But the documents they were going to gather were in apartment blocks in the ghetto. They were records of the afternoon meetings when people had tea at 4 o'clock. But what they were talking about in their committee were how many children died today, how much milk is there, how much medicine is there, what are the prospects, what diseases have broken out, and there were quarrels. And every day they gathered these documents together, and they were also amateur artists, sometimes children who were making drawing of other children in the schools that were in the ghetto, little musical scores. And Ringelblum, who realized that he was going to die in the Warsaw Uprising of April 1943, said we must gather these things and put them in milk churns. I don't know how that translates into Spanish. In big milk, empty milk containers, and bury them underground. And everybody involved in that enterprise of Oinok Shabbos died either in the concentration camps, the extermination camps, or in the ghetto uprising, except one man who jumped off the train on the way to Treblinka, who after the war was able to lead historians in Poland back to the places where these milk churns, you can see them in the Warsaw Jewish Museum. And out of the milk churns came these desperate voices of this catastrophic moment, but also things of great beauty. The pictures drawn by children, the occasional photograph. Ringelblum, before he joined the battle in April 1943, said, "I just wish I would be alive to actually see that we've defeated the Nazis in terms of their wish to exterminate memory." And the defeat of the campaign to exterminate memory is a real Jewish victory. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.